Hi, I'm Tony Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. Big shout out to this episode's sponsor, XL Coffee. XL are renowned organic coffee producers here in the UK who have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure their coffee is mold-free and has kept its antioxidant potency. XL are waking up the world of coffee. I'm a big fan and recommend you go give them a try. Use discount code NatLifePod at checkout. Details are in the show notes.
What if I told you you could take a magic pill, and with that pill you could become a better version of yourself, improve your family life, your health, your well-being, and that you could wake early, alert and on your A-game, and in those early hours of the morning, before work, you could write 2 books, study a master's, start a PhD, and build a business that was 70% more successful than the last that you'd worked for? Well, my next guest, Andy Ramage, has a few pearls of embodied wisdom to share on this. But Andy didn't take a magic pill. He just discovered how magic life can be when you give up the booze. It's 10 years since Andy went dry for January. He's remained sober for 10 years since, and through his books, classes, talks, and campaigns has helped thousands of others tap into their human potential. This is a great chat. Andy is always on fire. It's contagious, and I believe a great proof of concept. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did.
Welcome to the Nat Life Pod, man.
Oh, I'm loving this. I'm very honoured.
I'm so pleased you're here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've listened to so many of your pods now, and what always, I mean, I come away inspired, and mainly because of the amount of energy you have. Yeah. I have a lot of energy, but you behind a mic is like, wow.
Yeah.
You know? And that is, I mean, testament, I would say, to the sobriety. You know?
Yeah.
Like that shining example and someone that can really speak to that. It's February now, right?
It is.
And we've just done January. And January being the month where 1st of Jan, people are like, right, that's it, I'm doing it. I'm gonna go dry for a month. You know? And it starts there. So I thought this is a great timing because this is like January's done now.
Yeah.
Now what?
This is when the professionals come out to play.
Yeah.
Those that have maybe built a bit of momentum in Jan and then let's go. This is the best bit.
And here you are. So you started, when at the very beginning of no booze, right?
Yeah.
What was the length of time we're talking there?
So for me,
what was the longest period at the very beginning? Was it a few days? Was it like
a bit of a mixture? I think I played around with it for about 2 years. And I think that's quite interesting. When you listen to a lot of people, their build up to their sobriety or whatever you want to call it, is often quite a long period of time. It's really this overnight, never again moment. I mean, I'd said never again probably about 60 times. You know, the classic.
Yeah.
Never again. And then, of course,
I'm done.
A week later, maybe I'll have one, you know, back in that scenario. So there was definitely a lot of rolling around with it. I never really got past a month, in truth. It was a week here, 2 weeks there, but there was definitely momentum building over those 2 years. Mm. And I had this nagging feeling in the back of my mind. It was, I wonder, is alcohol getting in the way? Because it was such a blind spot. And I think it's such a blind spot to most people, isn't it? I was looking at my nutrition. I was looking at my diet. I even started meditating.
Yeah.
I was too anxious to meditate because I was always a little bit hungover.
Yeah.
So I didn't like focusing on my breath because it made me feel more anxious because I was already a little bit anxious from the sort of subtle hangovers that I didn't pick up on. My nutrition was inconsistent because it was McMuffin o'clock.
How can you have a handle on that?
Exactly. Yeah. You've got no chance. My exercise again, all over the place. 1 minute, you know, I was showing up like a hero. Next thing I was phoning in and cancelling. And the classic, I think I've got a bug excuse to the personal trainer. I mean, how many times have they heard that? So I hadn't, with all of that going on, the last thing I ever questioned was alcohol. It's interesting. And I think that's the same case for so many people in our society now.
Yeah, I like what you speak to. I think it's, was it middle lane drinkers?
Yes.
Yeah, because I know so many, and I was, for me, it was, yeah, I wouldn't call myself a middle lane drinker. I was definitely in the fast lane.
You went on the other lane.
Yeah, you know, overtaking men.
You whizzed past.
And your 10 days, yeah, I'm like, oh, yeah, I might have a 10-day break. It was just, if I was in it, I was in it, and it would go on for days, right? But, Yeah, I think with the middle lane stuff, it's so much, again, more relatable. And I'm sure if you speak to that, it might then highlight, I didn't see myself or view myself like that.
Yeah.
Because we're in London right now, in the city. And I'd say city life is probably a great place to observe middle lane drinking, you know, and the extremes, of course, but
yeah,
it's an environment that certainly breeds that, right?
Yeah, I think it's general. It's so ubiquitous, isn't it? So that middle lane for me, just to describe that for anyone listening, you've got the addicted end, the dependent end, and then you've got those that don't drink, like myself. So the middle lane basically is everyone in the middle.
Mm.
That's about over 70% of the UK population. It's about 2 billion people worldwide. That middle lane has been completely underserved and overlooked for the last 100 years. Whilst there's been great focus on addiction and dependency, and rightly so, which is still totally underserved and totally underfunded in truth, no one has ever focused on the middle lane. There's been that black and white mentality. It
could be possibly leading to the...
Oh, completely.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been a very black and white conversation around alcohol. You're either got a problem or you haven't. And if you haven't, you still drink, because why wouldn't you drink? You know, almost that confused people you can see in people's minds. That is starting to change. That was much more, I found that 10 years ago. But now we've got this beautiful conversation opening up about the middle lane. And I really believe the group that are actually suffering the most on a massive scale is the middle lane.
Because if we're talking the numbers you're talking about.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're the group that haven't really considered this. So they might be wondering why they're a bit grumpy, a bit tired, a bit overweight. They're not consistent in their exercise. Maybe they're beating themselves up for not having the willpower. Maybe they've lost a bit of ambition. Maybe their relationships are not quite where they want to be. Maybe they've lost a bit of zest and spark and feeling a bit haggard. Most of that, if you start to unpick it, and we can do that through the podcast, is often related to those one or two drinks. So this is not extremities of drinking. Even one or two is going to destroy your sleep. We know what sleep does to our body, our mind, our mental health. And then a few more at the weekend, when you compound those things and then stretch it over decades, I think it's the greatest sort of health and wellness travesty, I'd go as far to say, of the 21st century. I think it's huge when you start to look at it.
Yeah, it's a saboteur of many, because even in the my early days of, forget the army, because it was like very booze fueled, but in my kind of early personal training days, it was still celebrated, right? Yeah, I mean, you're in a health and wellness industry and you're training people and you're holding space in that sense and taking people on a journey and their journey into health and wellness. And yet there was still a booze culture around it. Like, you'd go and get hammered. And I remember I had a gig in, it was a metal trading firm. So they were traders.
That's right, yeah.
And I was a trainer in there. And so I was in there for 2 days a week. It was my first gig in London. And I just had to be on call for the three guys who set it up, right? Three traders who set this trading company up. And I just had to be available. And most of the time I was just in the space. And it gave me a great opportunity to just sit and really study my craft. So I was in head in the books and trainings. I was probably in the best shape ever because I had so much time to be able to honor it. But the scene outside that gym, that was like in days of China White, going to China White, and the state people would get in, right? And then be on the floor the next day. And it was like just that was the culture, you know? So that's like, that's a good 25 years ago now.
Yeah. And to a degree, it's changed, but it hasn't changed that much. I'm still heavily involved in the world of broking. I go back and train big groups of brokers right now. Mindset training is a lot of what I do. We can talk about that a bit later, but that world is still going on in a big way. It's changed in that there's more alcohol-free alternatives, and it's definitely becoming more acceptable to not always drink, which is a great move. You know, when I got into this 10 years ago, I think 10 years ago was probably about the height of it, actually, when there was no alcohol-free alternatives.
Yeah, because for those that don't know, you were a broker, right?
Yeah, so a broker and lived that lifestyle. That was me in China Whites and all the carry-on that went with that. That's sort of part and parcel of what you did, brokers entertain. I think I was probably the first ever broker that proactively decided to stop drinking. It was just, no one had ever done that in that industry. It just wasn't a thing. In fact, to the point my boss at the time, who was also my hero and my mentor, said to me, I got about 2 weeks into my first break from alcohol, and he pulled me to one side and said, look, Andy, where are you going with this? And I was like, I don't know. I'm enjoying it. I'm feeling so good for it. And he sort of took me to one side and said, look, if you continue this, I think you're finished. I think your career is going to be over. No one's going to want to go out of a broker that doesn't drink. Now, you imagine the social pressure packed into that. That was like my career on the line. You know, I was the sole breadwinner of my family. Someone saying to me, if you continue to do this thing, which is unbelievably good for you, I think your career's over. But as it transpired, the results that I got were so powerful, I thought, do you know what? Stick your job up your ass. I actually don't care what you think. I'm going to continue with this, which I did. And it was the greatest thing for my career. It was my USP. I was that broker that didn't drink. So I had to entertain people in a different way. It wasn't, let's just go to the boring pub. They've all done that a million times. I was taking them surfing, yoga, Barry's boot camp.
Really seeing them as well, right?
And like,
and remembering the next day what was actually in the conversation.
Yeah, and they were loving that someone was doing something different for them. And then what I started to notice, and this was that cultural sort of revelation to me, if I take six clients out and I was the first to order, and I'd order an alcoholic drink, it's that sort of macho environment that sends that message to the next person. Well, this is a drinking table. Therefore, if the head of the table, the first person to order the drink, orders a drink, I'll have a drink. Six people have a drink on a Tuesday lunchtime. In my mind, I always thought, I bet most of that table don't want to drink, but they haven't got the courage to say no. Fast forward to me not drinking in the exact same environment. First to order a drink, sparkling water, a non-alcoholic drink. The next person, very often, given the choice, will order a non-alcoholic drink. So then I started to notice, I was right, 50% of the table weren't drinking because clearly they never wanted to drink. All those years, they just didn't have the courage or permission to do so. So that for me was a revelation. And once I started to see that, I knew even in that industry that supposedly prized alcohol, I realized actually, I don't think they do. I think underneath it all, there's a lot of people in there that realize they want to go home to their partners. They want to be fit. They want to wake up the next day not hungover. They want to be on top form. They want to excel in their careers. So actually, even in that space that was awash with the booze that you thought you could never do it, it was the best thing that ever happened to my career. I grew a business 7 times bigger in half the time than my previous business in that environment whilst not drinking. Yeah. I did it all whilst not drinking. It was the greatest gift.
It is, it, right? I mean, that's a huge banner as well to those that are in that industry, right? I mean, it's fascinating. I think it's also outside of that, though, of course, all the relationships are benefits. So the business is growing, of course, you know, but also the family's growing with that. You know, you're showing up. So that's the real authentic Andy in all of those environments, right?
Oh, that was...
There's no hiding. There's no shame. There's no guilt or anything else that's associated with that.
Yeah. And how many people are carrying... And this is what I'm talking about, the middle lane. People's mental well-being in the middle lane. Not only is it destroyed through poor sleep, and actually, you know, we can get into what actually happens inside your brain when you drink alcohol, just blowing up your neurochemistry. It's the little white lies that everyone carries. Like, we all do it. It's the cancelled train that was never really cancelled. It was the one drink. Like, how many people in Liverpool Street tonight will be saying, phoning up their partner?
As long as they're saying that and I can, and it's not, I can park the car.
Yeah.
But yeah,
there is that. Oh, the trains are delayed again. You know, it's that, like, I was doing all of that. And then you end up with this little web of what appear to be little white lies, but they chip away at people's trust because other people know it's bullshit.
Yeah.
They know it's not true. You know it's not true.
There's a slight slur in your voice. And
yeah. You know, I've had one drink.
How you smell when you get home. And,
all of that. And I think they, I don't think you realize the actual damage that does over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Not in the short term, but over like decades. And for most people, it's over decades. So with that removed, there was just like a weight lifted off my shoulders. I could actually go home, read a bedtime story to my girls and not be sort of slightly slurry up. And again, this is middle lane stuff. This is not ridiculously excessive stuff. Even those 2 or 3 drinks, and you know, your kids can smell it on your breath, can't they? Being present all the time, being fit, feeling strong, like a man again, like getting that power back in my life. That for me was, again, a revelation. I'd lost a lot of that. And I see that all the time. I work with so many elite performers across sport, business, and I see a lot of people losing that, that power inside them. It actually, I think it chips it away. I describe it like kryptonite. I think it's like carrying kryptonite in your backpack for 10 or 20 years. And when you remove it, you feel like Superman. That's how I felt, anyway.
Incredible. Yeah, I too. I mean, massive shifts in my life from eventually being able to just say, that's it, I'm done, you know? And went through many different experiences to get to that, I'm done, very different path, right? For me, it had to be deep kind of immersion, psychedelic experiences, whatever it is, but it meant I could just park it and left it. And it just a very different path here. We're talking about like for the middle lane drinker, again, that you've gone through a process of like, was it the longer? It was 28 days to begin with, right?
Yeah, I floated a week, 2 weeks. But once I cracked 28 days, I haven't looked back. That's 10 years ago, pretty much.
I mean, we're talking 10 years.
10 years, March 1st.
Incredible time.
Yeah.
You know, length of time to say, oh, I haven't had a drink.
Yeah.
After 28 days.
Yeah. And I still don't know when it will end. But like, why? Like, my mindset is, why would I drink? It makes no sense. I could drink tomorrow, but why would I? If you know what I mean? I know it's not going to do anything for me. All it's ever going to do is take away from the life that I've built. It'll take away my time, my energy, my looks, my health. I'll probably put on weight. I won't be the partner that I want to be. I won't be the parent that I want to be. I won't be the athlete that I want to be. I won't be the entrepreneur that I want to be. So sort of, why would I do it? It's is my frame of mind with it. Therefore, I could do it. But I choose not to, because why the hell would I?
So you originally, we can go back your story to football, right?
Yeah.
Pro footballer.
Yeah.
Gillingham,
yeah, and Leyton Orient.
Okay. And then injury came in. We've just been discussing the injury. What was the scene like then?
I mean, that was very much sort of work hard, play hard.
There's still the play hard element within that.
Yeah.
We had a lot of rugby players on recently, and there's away from it again, lots of play hard kind of experience. And it was fashioned again within football. If I remember back, it was like, you know, we had the Gascoignes and everyone really boozing at that stage. You know, it was celebrated, cocktails being poured down in the dentist chair and stuff like that. So it was big on the scene, wasn't it? You know?
Yeah, that was my era of football, when it was still very prevalent to drink sort of Brian Robson sort of. It was just part of that bonding
again,
culture.
Again, it was in the culture, right?
Yeah, and that's what everyone did. So you would have been very much the odd one out had you not been drinking in that environment. Did you need to drink to be in the team? Absolutely not. But you wouldn't have bonded as well with the team. So it just was an unwritten thing, but no one ever questioned it. No one was ever thinking, actually, if I have a few too many, maybe I won't play as well on a Saturday. But we were still disciplined. We wouldn't go out after a Thursday, for example. So the last time you might go out would be a Wednesday. But even when I was playing, most of the time, you'd have a big Saturday, maybe a bit of a Sunday, and then you wouldn't. So it wasn't excessive, far from it, but it was still very prevalent. Yeah. And I think that's been one of the big shifts over the last decade or so. Again, I'm involved back in football now with the Professional Footballers Association. So they have a business school.
Amazing.
Yeah, which has been
nice to hear, like that full cycle.
Yeah, it's been such a lovely experience. I invested in a sports agency as one of the many things that I'm involved in. So I started training a lot of professional footballers, transitioning them for their career after football. Professional Footballers Association, PFA, got wind of it, invited me in. Now I'm a big part of their business school, which is brilliant. And we've trained some amazing players over the last 6 months. But if you look at the shift in those footballers, they don't drink anymore. I mean, it's very rare. I know we've had a recent story about Marcus Rashford going out, but it's really incredibly rare. They can't. They're wired up to heart rate monitors.
Yeah, yeah.
You can see the difference in your heart rate instantly. Yeah. If you've been out the night before and you show up to training the next day, your heart rate might be elevated by 10, 20 beats.
But also you can see the difference.
Yeah.
You know, you can really see the difference in players today.
Yeah.
You know?
It's changed.
Like there's that to it, you know, very clear athleticism that's involved with that, right?
Oh,
not that there wasn't athleticism before, but, you know, there is a big shift towards how, I guess, on their game, we could call that.
Yeah, and that's something that I really love celebrating, because I think if you go back to when I was playing football, it was true to the fan in the terrace that their hero was drinking a lot. Because everyone did it. But I think what's happened is the players have all become really professional, but the average person in the stand still thinks and likes to believe that their heroes are going out boozing it up on a Saturday night, when that's just not the case anymore. They just can't do it. And I think there's so much cultural mythology around it. It's like entrepreneurs.
Mm.
You know, there's that sense that all these amazing entrepreneurs are going out, like Richard Branson, they're quaffing Vino Calypso and champagne. When they're not, there's no one playing life at that level, the elite level, in anything, who's going out and getting smashed every night and playing at the elite level. They might give that appearance they are. And I was having this conversation with a guy called Bill Schufelt. I don't know if you know Bill. He owns Athletic Brewing. He's taken that in 5.5 years. It's an alcohol-free drinks brand. It's going to be a $1 billion business in 5.5 years, which is insane. He doesn't drink, 10 years alcohol-free like myself. But I was telling him the story.
Say it again, go on. 10 years. Yes.
Get in there. Yeah. You know what? I've spent 10 years celebrating everyone else's alcohol-free streak, so I'm going to keep saying it.
It's a great place to get to.
But he said to me, which I loved, because I was using Richard Branson as a great example of the cultural mythology, because you often see Branson with a glass of something, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Necker Island, he's got a glass of fizz.
And Necking said, it on Necker Island.
Yeah. So he, again, I think in some ways, you know, feeds that message. But actually, Bill said he'd heard Branson talking, and Branson said, no, I actually rarely ever drink. He said, if you see me in a photo with something that looks like a drink, invariably it's not a drink. And if it's got alcohol in it, I barely touch it. And there's case in point again. You know, you can't run and play life at that elite level in any domain and be hungover and drinking, even in the middle lane, is my opinion.
Well, even if you're drinking 3 days a week, right? So it could be, what is that, Friday night? Well, it starts on a Thursday now, really, yeah? So if there's a Thursday night, a Friday night, a Saturday night, then there's going to be a good few days getting over that, yeah? And then you're back in again. Or there's the recovery booze to deal with the hangover,
yeah,
which people do, right? Is that in the middle lane or is that just my world?
No. That's sort of semi-middle lane.
Yeah. You know, fast. I've got to have a hair as a dog kind of conversation. And then where does that go, you know? So you've got, what, 1-2 days a week where you're going to be on your game?
Well.
And if you, how can you possibly be on your game if you're dealing with hangovers for days, you know, or inebriated?
Well, let's look at that. So let's just say you're a middle lane drinker, yeah, and you drink midweek. The truth is it really probably takes you 2-3 days to get over that. There's the obvious day after, but then there's the day after that, you're not quite on your point. Your sleep's really suffered because alcohol destroys the quality of your sleep. Probably takes 2.5-3 days. So if you go out again at the weekend and have a couple more, and maybe on a Saturday and a couple on a Sunday, like you say, there's your 3 days. That means you're never ever getting back to your 100%. So how many people have lived their life for decades, not just a year.
We are talking decades, yeah.
It's decades.
Remembering what it was like to be properly sober.
They don't know. They don't know. So they think they're at 100%, but their new normal might be 50% or 60% of what they're capable of. And that's that kryptonite that I was talking about. Most people are unaware in the middle lane because they haven't taken a break for long enough to figure out, oh, what it really feels like to be at their optimal health. And that's what changed my life. That's why I'm here. Because I had that experience. I think I was probably operating at 50% of what I was capable of in every domain of my life. But I thought I was at 100%. I had it all together, big job, big career, you know, nice things, nice house, lovely family. I thought, right, I've reached my 100%. And I plateaued and I got that sense that, is this it?
Yeah, there's an air of disappointment in that, right?
Yeah, well, I've sort of made it. That's what I've been working for.
Sometimes I don't feel like this.
Yeah, this is crap.
Yeah.
This is not what I was told it was going to be. I thought I was going to be literally moonwalking in and out of the office and high-fiving everyone at Liverpool Street. And I look around and think, everyone looks like me.
Yeah.
They all look tired and bored and fed up and grey and forlorn and hungover. Yet we're all, anyone that's in Liverpool Street, you know, smartly dressed, clearly is in a financial position to have most things they need, i.e. the basics covered in life. Yet why is everyone so unhappy? And I think the root cause of all of this stuff for most people, it certainly was for me, was alcohol. When you remove it, suddenly that 50% went to 60%. I was like, oh, this is good. Then it went to 70, then it went to 80, then it went to 90. And that now even, you know, almost at 50, you know, I'm fitter, faster and healthier and more energetic and loving life more than when I was 30. That's a 20-year difference. Yeah. It's incredible.
I love the way you approached it. Like, you, again, you tried meditation, you looked at sleep, you did this, because if you're not addressing that, then you could feel that, oh, there's suffering there. So therefore, the alcohol is being used to deal with the suffering. But if I'm putting all these other practices in that should mean that I'm feeling really well, but I haven't removed alcohol and yet I'm still feeling not great. Okay, there's one thing that has to go, surely. Then remove that and then see what it looks like. Because for me, it's like within, it could be discussing addiction, which is separate to this middle lane, would be what's the suffering that's leading to the pacifier. But if we're talking about people, again, like you say, that they should have all their needs met, why are they suffering? Are they suffering because they're suffering because they're literally just hungover? Yeah. And dealing with the ills or the effects of alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating point because Gabor Mate says, doesn't he, not why the problem, why the pain?
Yeah.
Which I love. And I think underneath there might be something that needs work on. Again, yeah. That could be an anxiety, it could be depression, could be a marriage that's not working. I mean, people go through these things all the time. But very often, when you remove alcohol, I think it's the best opportunity you get to address those things with a clear head. Otherwise, it just gets lost in the fog. Mm. I see so many people when they take a break from alcohol realize they've been depressed. And then they take real proactive steps around that. And that might be medication, that might be talk therapy. But then they're actually dealing with the root of the problem as opposed to trying to mask it through alcohol, which is only making the issue worse.
And leading to more depression.
Yeah, exactly. It's that negative spiral. Or actually masking an unhappy marriage. And then they sit down and do that work and maybe they realise they weren't meant for each other. That happens a lot of the time as well. But that's proactive. But equally, I think for lots of people, the thing that's causing all of the problem is alcohol. And when it's removed, that's the game changer. And it was for me. So I had terrible anxiety. I'd never experienced anxiety in my life. And then for about 10 years, really started to get it, proper full-blown panic attack style anxiety that anyone who's experienced will know it's debilitating, it's horrific. And I just thought I was developing, you know, mental health issues. And I was very fortunate. When I stopped drinking, it went away and it's never, ever come back. And now I understand, because what was happening in my brain chemistry, the overstimulation of the neurotransmitter GABA and then the pacifier of glutamate and then the rebound effect.
We just literally had that conversation.
Oh, but yeah, you have, haven't you? Yeah, the rebound effect was causing me this anxiety.
Professor David Nutt.
Yeah, who's a hero of mine.
Yeah.
By the way, and that's, now I understand what that was. So obviously once that was removed for me, and of course it's not a panacea for everyone with anxiety, but for me, it literally went away and it's never, ever come back. How many people right now are suffering with mental health issues that might be directly linked to alcohol that would just vanish if they took a break? Like, this is what I'm always interested in. I think the first conversation we should have when we sit down with someone and talk about mental health is, what's your relationship like with alcohol? Yeah, it's rarely ever mentioned. You know, I think the first conversation we should have when someone is talking of tweaking their diet is alcohol. Or if they're talking about their nutritional, their movement plan is alcohol. Or their relationships. What's your relationship like with alcohol? That's, I think, for me, this is where we should start every conversation, because I think it's the root cause of the middle lane, this huge issue that when it's removed, it's just joyous.
Yeah, and it's so ingrained, right? That it's been so normalised within this culture. Like, how many people do you hear, like, I'm stressed, I'm going to have a glass of this, or I'm just going to have this. And again, that is also being observed by the kids.
Yeah.
Right? So it could be, I've had a really stressful day, I'm just going to sit down, I'm just going to put a breathing app on and do 5 rounds of breath, 4-6 tempo to downregulate, to deal with the stress. But it's not at this stage. We're at this stage where it's, I'm going to open a bottle of wine, I'll have a glass of wine because I'm stressed. The kids see, that's our mechanism for dealing with stress. And that's what I observed.
Yeah.
As a child, then into teenage years, and then even into my mature years, and still observing it now as a nearly 49-year-old man when I visit my parents, right? It's the same relationship that's there, right? It's so ingrained again, you know?
It's incredible, really. And even the relaxation, you know, approach, as you said, for many people. And firstly, it doesn't really help you relax. It just, again, as we mentioned, it basically stimulates this neurotransmitter GABA, which starts to shut things down. And it starts to shut parts of your brain down. So your prefrontal cortex is the first thing it closes down, which is the bit that makes you human, essentially. So your control center goes offline. It's the first thing that goes offline. But it gives you that sort of almost Valium-like effect. That's the relaxation effect of it. But obviously what goes up must come down. So, you know, if you were to have 2 drinks and stop drinking, it's the experiment. Do you feel more relaxed or less relaxed? You feel less relaxed because you go into that horrible sort of mini withdrawal state, don't you? Of now I'm a bit tired and a bit groggy. This is crap. I feel 10 times
more.
So yeah, there's only one way out of that is to drink more and more and more and more. So this is the trap that we get into. And I think what happens if you speak to most adults and say, how do you relax? First thing they're going to say is, I have a drink.
Yeah.
And they've stopped searching for ways to actually relax without alcohol. I always describe it a bit like the cuckoo in the nest of your mind. I'm like a big bird watcher. A bit random. Little
Twitcher
kid.
Or bird watcher?
Twitcher.
Twitcher. Wow, man. Yeah, serious.
I was this little tough kid growing up in Dagenham, and I loved bird watching and knitting with my nans. And no one ever knew. It's only now I'm just starting to reveal these hidden secrets, but I've always been fascinated by birds. And the bird, the cuckoo, if you've ever seen it, which you would have done, is nature at its most brutal, yep. isn't it? You know, it lays its eggs, its chicks hatch. They're about 10 times the size of the other little chicks. And you just want to scream at the telly, it's a bloody cuckoo. Stop feeding the cuckoo. Mm-hmm. And of course, the cuckoo's programmed by nature to kick the other chicks out. And eventually the birds come back and their chicks are all gone. This whopping great big cuckoo, and then it flies off. And I think alcohol is a little bit like that. It gets into our brain and we don't see it. And it just starts to kick out all the other things we used to enjoy, all the things that we used to do to relax. Mm. And eventually we're just left with this whopping great big cuckoo. And that's what frustrates me. I just want to shout at people, it's a cuckoo. And they've got no other ways to relax. How do you relax? I just have a drink.
A saboteur.
They've got nothing left. They've got nothing left. Whereas when you take a break, and then you have to find real ways that actually help you relax, such as breathing, such as reading, such as running, such as whatever it is for you. The power in that is monumental, because not only does it actually help you relax, you're less stressed the next day because you haven't just blown up your neurochemistry, which will cause you more anxiety and more stress the next day. So it's this virtuous cycle of thriving rather than that downward spiral that so many people, unbeknownst to them, because I think that's the big part, it's just a lack of awareness, I think, at the moment, which I'm frustrated about and what I'm trying to change.
Well, you are changing.
Yeah.
I don't see, I mean, I'd remove the trying from that. You are doing it, man. You know?
Yeah,
you're doing it. It's there. You're doing a documentary right now, right?
Yes, this is something to talk about. I'm absolutely thrilled. It was never meant to be a thing. What happened, a guy called John Hyatt made a brilliant documentary. Well, he's made many great documentaries, one called Screened Out, which is about phone usage and our kids.
Yeah.
That ended up being shown in Congress over in the US. They created a whole bill of around it. There's loads of research around it. It's been a massive success. He got in touch with me because he was making a new documentary on health and wellbeing. So he went all around the world to interview like the bright minds in health and wellness. In the process of that, he took a break from alcohol. He watched my TED talk, The Limitless Appeal, sort of really liked it, listened to a few of the podcasts, took a break, felt amazing, got into the editing room. And he went around all of these incredible gurus in the wellness space. Not one of them mentioned alcohol. And he's like, how can that possibly be? I've just literally interviewed all of the top names in the health and wellness space about health and wellness. None of them are talking about alcohol. Could you come and be part of the documentary? Which I agreed to. And in that conversation, I just batted back and said, there's got to be space for a documentary like a Game Changers.
Yeah, yeah.
Did for plant-based, for alcohol-free. And he came straight back and said, you're absolutely bang on. You're on. Fast forward a year and a half. We've filmed the sizzle, and it's all Hollywood stuff. So we filmed a little trailer. It's now in production.
It's a lot of work, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be, this is like a year, 2 year sort of project, but we go out to LA to start the filming, and there's a load going on with it. So really that is just an exploration and a celebration of the alcohol-free movement and all the benefits and all the joys and all the wins, which is sort of my approach, but also then to start asking some of those deeper questions as to why. How have we ended up in this insane situation where so many people are still completely unaware, in the middle lane, of how alcohol is impacting their life in terms of their health, in terms of their productivity, in terms of their sleep? People are just unaware. And that for me is a big question that we have to go and explore.
Yeah, whether they're prepared to ask themselves, you know, that's it. Do you think it's an age thing? Do you think it's an age group within it?
Yeah.
Like even within the middle laners?
Oh, yeah.
I think the younger generations now, there's definitely more alignment, I would say, with what well-being is, you know, what it is to be a well-being. It feels anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's a geographic location even to that, but what do you think the age group is? Where do you think we're at with the middle laners?
I think it's sort of 30, 70 almost, maybe 35, 70. I think that's the big bracket. It's probably our generation, in truth. You're 48, almost 49, I'm 49. I think we're right in the middle of it, the heart of the sort of booze culture.
Yeah.
So I've got a 15 going on 16-year-old and 18-year-old. And neither of them really drink. And my wife drinks, good Irish girl. She's always drunk through all of this. It was my choice not to drink. And, you know, I'd never pressured anyone else. So they've had both those role models in their lives. They choose not to drink, but neither do their friends, really. Mm-hmm. I'm just not seeing it as much. I mean, they've got opportunities that never existed before. For example, My daughter, a couple of years ago, went to a 16th birthday party and she just grabbed a bottle of Nosecco out the fridge because we've always got that type of stuff in the house. And I remember her leaving.
Nosecco, so that's like an alcohol-free Prosecco.
Yeah, okay, yeah, exactly, Nosecco. And I remember her leaving the house and I thought, oh no, is she going to get like bullied, the mick taken out of her? She's going to be the only kid that rock, you know, playing life through my lens, right? When I was 16, had you rocked up with something that was non-alcoholic, you'd have been absolutely lambasted for it. So there's my daughter going out and I'm like, oh no, how's this going to go? Anyway, she goes to the party, comes back. I went, how'd you get on? She went, oh, it's great. And I went, how'd you get on with the Nosecco? And she went, oh yeah, loads of the kids had it. So loads of the, you know, so you might say your dad's this guy in the alcohol-free space, hence why you turned up with alcohol-free, but their parents weren't. And yeah, all these kids turning up with Nosecco, so it looks the real deal. They pop the cork, they pour the fizz. I mean, that's a cultural shift that I've seen in the last few years, which for me has been the most exciting thing. Because I've been in at this 10 years ago when no one really got it, no one really cared. And now I see this wonderful evolution of like alcohol-free drinks that is just changing everything, which for me is the most exciting thing.
When did the 1 year no beer?
Yeah.
When did that drop in?
That about 8 years ago.
Is it 8 years already?
Yeah. So I've got people now, I put out an ebook 8 years ago. I wrote this little ebook, it's about 10,000 words. And it was that fresh approach of there's nothing to give up, everything to gain. You're going to feel amazing. You're going to look incredible. You're going to lose weight. That lovely messaging. And I got in touch with a guy just recently who's coming to now train with me as a coach.
Yeah.
His name's Carl. He read that book 9 years ago.
Wow.
He's still alcohol free. He met his now partner, Claire, who's 8 years alcohol free. It's still alcohol free. It's pretty cool. That's how long I've been doing it. I've been cheering on people for the best part of 9 years.
It's incredible, man.
Yeah.
So what about tools?
Tools and techniques.
You know, so if I'm someone who's a middle lane drinker, but I still want to go out and socialize, you know? What do you advise? If I wanted to get to that 20, that's 28 days. So if that was the minimum for me.
Yeah, I think where it has changed are the alcohol-free alternatives. I think that's made it so much easier now to go out and socialize. And people are used to that, aren't they now? It's getting to that lovely cultural stage where you could order a non-alcoholic drink. And I think it puts people at ease. You know, there's less social pressure if you've got something that looks like a drink and tastes like a drink. I think it actually helps other people. Mm. It relieves their social tension. Whereas before, again, when I started, if you stood there with a Coca-Cola, whatever it might be, it was just like a beacon that everyone was attracted to sort of try and stop you drinking, you know, non-alcoholic because they just felt uncomfortable. Whereas when you've got a non-alcoholic beer in your hand, for example, the pressure's off. So that's the game changer. I think that's the number one place to start. And what's beautiful, most pubs, clubs, restaurants now stock alcohol-free, again, which is like a cultural transformation only in the last couple of years. So I think it's alcohol-free alternatives, first and foremost. Don't lock yourself away. Go and be more courageous and connect with people. And I think what everyone will start to discover, that social, this is on a social setting we're talking about, the social anxiety that you experience, why most people drink, that's why I would drink predominantly, it actually goes away after about 15 minutes. It's this magical thing. And I think if you go back to evolution, you can start to get a feel for that. I think if you walk into a room with lots of strangers, your evolutionary brain is wired to be on red alert, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know what's going on. You can imagine if
so
that
you feel at ease again.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you sit with it, of course, that evolutionary part of your brain says, it's okay.
Mm.
Actually, these are good people. This is fine.
Lean into the first 15.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Lean into the first 15. And I think if you do
There's a book in there, Andy.
There is. Joe Wick. We'll have to get Joe Wick. Yeah. I think you'll have something like that. I don't know if he'd be all right with us doing that. Yeah. Lean into
the first 15. Joe, what do you think of this one?
Yeah. But I think that's so important because when you have that experience, and which is really strange, I only had that experience myself, even though I've been at this 10 years, about 3 or 4 years ago. I went on a boat party. I mentioned it earlier.
Yeah.
The No Booze Cruise.
Yeah.
With a guy called Matt Pink up and down the Thames. And I'm really introverted. People don't realise that. I can do the sort of the front man-y kind of stuff. But I actually am. I am.
So that means you're, in that case, an introvert that's learned extrovert traits.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I can sort of almost become that person if I need to. But given my own choice, I'm relatively shy in social settings.
Get me back home. I need to recover.
Solitude, energy,
yeah.
Books. So in a room of a lot of people, I always find that difficult. So I'm on a boat, there's 250 people on there, and I had that anxiety thing going on. Couldn't escape the boat, you know, that sort of a thing. It was like, right. And lots of people are there, you know, it's all in the alcohol-free space. And I had that heightened sense of sort of anxiety again, like I used to experience. And then, of course, I leaned into the 15.
Love that.
And it went away. And I was almost on the boat going, oh, I've never noticed that so vividly and viscerally before, which really reminded me. So I think if you can have that experience, it's a powerful one, because all those years you might have been drinking to get over the first 15, if you just didn't drink for the first 15, it would go away anyway, naturally. Then you wouldn't have to do that thing that's going to make you poor at your job in the morning and, you know, with the hangover, inconsistent in everything that you do and all those things. So I think they're two massive tips, but also let your friends know. I think you've got to get ahead of the curve a little bit, because we've always got that one mate, haven't we, that's in our social circle very often, that's quite dominant. And if they're the one that is on board with your choice to not drink for whatever reason, they're much more likely to cheer you on and support you. Whereas if you don't have that conversation, you try to do it socially on a night out, it's always more difficult. So I think it's get ahead of the curve a little bit. If you've got that certain person,
get them on side,
alcohol-free alternatives, lean into the first 15. There we go.
Love that. I used to offer to be the driver, you know?
Yeah.
I'd have sparkling water, fresh lime, that would be it. And when it was first in, my friends would still, you know, oh, come on, man, you know? And a number of times that we'd meet, and then eventually I could turn up and there would just be a sparkling water, lime, done.
Yeah.
You know? Just they had to get familiar with the behaviour as well. And they're so used to that kind of, oh, am I going to be judged? You know, that kind of behaviours come in, you know? Which really, they're too smashed anyway, come like 2 hours in, you know?
Well, that was...
To care.
I had a lovely experience. So all my best mates are Irish. And, you know, that I haven't been drinking for years. And they really go out of their way. They're like my biggest supporters, even though all of our lives we spent that we were just like pub culture. That's how we met. And they've been brilliant about it. So we all went away mountain biking in Ireland. So they organised mountain biking basically to keep us out the pub as long as possible.
Yeah.
And of course, we go mountain biking all day around Galway. And then they go to the pub at night. And I wouldn't drink. They'd have a few beers. Nothing like outrageous. So we then got on a little ferry over to one of the Aran Islands. So, and again, another day of mountain biking. I'm going to this fort called Dunangus, which is a real mythical place. It's an incredible place. And we arrive over, it's 10:30 in the morning. We get off the ferry. It is sheet rain. You can't see for the rain. So you can imagine in this little island off the coast of Ireland, there's nothing else open and there's nothing else to do. The mountain biking wasn't going to happen in that weather. Pub's open. So we're in the pub at 10:30. I'd say by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the lads are already on the table, singing, repeating them, you know, all the usual. I'm just like, oh, I thought I'm in for an absolute disaster here. This is like my worst nightmare, effectively. Anyway, I look out the window and the sun's coming out a little bit. And I thought, I think I'm just going to go. I think I'm just going to try and do what we were supposed to do. But I couldn't even ask the lads what the arrangements were, because if I'd said it to them, they would have headlocked me. You know, when they're in that state, you just got to go. So I just walk out this pub. I don't know where I am, where I'm going, what the arrangements are. I just knew this one place, this Dunangus. So I just started walking. Just started walking in a direction. I thought, the island can't be that big. I'll just walk. The sun comes out and I'm walking and walking, literally for hours. I ended up walking about 6 hours, like on my own, in solitude. And then eventually I came to this Dunangus fort. There's no one around. I hadn't seen anyone for 2 or 3 hours. And I sort of turn a corner. You have to climb over some old like ruins. And then you just get hit with this sheer wall drop. It's about 100 meters sheer vertical wall drop into the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
And I stood on the edge of this cliff and had what I considered to be something that felt like a very spiritual experience. It was powerful. It blew me away. That solitude, clearly a very spiritual place, just the power of nature, that sheer granite cliff. You know, I'm even getting goosebumps thinking about it.
Yeah, truth bumps.
Yeah, it was just something so that will live with me forever. And then I left Dunangus and I walked back with the biggest smile on my face. It was just beautiful. I walked back for hours and hours and hours. Bear in mind, I'm out for like 10 odd hours now. So of course I arrived back. I'm now back at the pub 12 hours later. It's 10:30 at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I poke my head in and I see the lads in the same spot on the same table talking the same shite. And for me, that was a massive moment of realization, that sliding doors moment of I could have been there with the lads and I've done that a million times and they will get nothing from that. And they're all going to wake up the next day and they're going to feel horrible and feel terrible.
Won't remember after conversation. No.
And it was interesting for the first 2 hours when I was there anyway.
Mm.
And I've been where we were supposed to go with a clear head, clear mind, and had one of the most powerful experiences of my life. And for me, that was such a wake-up call to think, how many opportunities like that have we missed out on?
Are we missing?
Because we're stuck in the blooming pub or we're having those one or two drinks and we can't quite be bothered to do the things. So that was, for me, that absolute, like, wonderful sort of JOMO, as they say, that joy of missing out.
Joy of missing out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there, well, of course, there is the fear of missing out for some, right? How did your family handle it?
They're really good. My wife was brilliant. I actually, this is, I guess, one of those sort of weird moments of, I stopped drinking, inspired another guy called Ruri. We ended up co-founding Money No Beer.
Yeah.
We got about a year in, so he'd done his year effectively. He decided to have a drink. So I'm now a year and a half in.
Oh, so he did what, like a celebration at the end of the year? Or?
He'd done it, but he was inspired by me, done a year off,
yeah,
and decided, right, I've done my year, so now I might go back to moderation and all that. Not my choice. Yeah. I don't think it's a good idea. But anyway, that was his choice. But it threw me a bit of a curveball. You know, I was 18 months in and I had one of those moments of, actually, well, if he can drink, I can have a drink. You know, I was a middle-aged drinker. I wasn't a problematic drinker. Therefore, why wouldn't I have a drink? And I've got myself into this tiz, as it were. You know, one of those mental sort of headlocks, walking up and down my kitchen going, well, if he can have a drink, I can have a drink. You know, almost talking to myself into like this storm. And I thought, right, when Tara comes home, who was always been my drinking buddy, that's how we met. Again, our, you know, social circles, real sort of boozy, clubby kind of group. I thought, when Tara comes home, I'm going to obviously tell her this story, and no doubt she's going to turn around and go, brilliant, don't tell anyone, let's have a few drinks and, you know, let's get back on it. And she walked back in the front door and I was like, Tara, this has happened and I'm just thinking, what will I do? And
I'm in turmoil, right?
Yeah, yeah. And she just looked at me and went, why would you do that? Why would you ever go back to that, the way it made you feel, the way it made you look at all you've created, look at all you've done, look how like amazing you've been in terms of being a husband, brilliant, a father. And it was such a beautiful moment. Boom. And that was it. That was it. You know, that was it, killed me. It's like, no, exactly. Why would I? Why would I do that? So as much as her relationship with me must have changed in quite a dramatic way.
Well, she's seen you for the man you are.
Yeah.
Right?
And she, you know, we have a wonderful relationship with that. Tara still drinks, does her thing. And I'm quite happy to leave her to it. You know, if she has a few too many, I'm like, yeah, you crack on. I'll see her at home. I'll see you later on. And we just have a nice way with it, right? And, you know, I think that's been nice for us. Then, you know, our girls have grown up with that lovely role modeling from either parent. They can pick and choose. But what is funny, Tara won't mind me saying this, but my girls can see it. They can see when she's had a few drinks. And you don't notice it when you're both drinking. Do you know what I mean? But when you've got one of your parents that doesn't drink, obviously Tara does change. Everyone changes when they have a few drinks. And I can see my daughters, I don't think, look at my wife to think, wow, that's aspirational. It's more like eye rolling.
Here we go.
Yeah, here we go. So I think that in itself is quite powerful. Do you know what I mean? And maybe if both parents were drinking, they wouldn't notice the sort of difference as much, but I think they really see it, and I don't think it feels aspirational to them, is the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. Yeah, if I think, well, what about, are your parents still around?
Yep.
How are they? How's that?
They're great.
How's their relationship with it?
Yeah, I mean, my dad was a broker in the city, an insurance broker, reinsurance broker. So they were like the biggest boozers before the money brokers come along. So he'd be very similar to me, look similar to me, similar lifestyle, would have been a big drinker for all that period. Again, the big sort of social kind of drinker. He had a treble heart bypass about 10 years ago now, which was a big wake up call for me and for him. Stopped drinking, still drinks now, but not as much as he did. Mum still drinks, brother still drink, all my best mates still drink. Basically, everyone around me still drinks apart from me and apart from all the wonderful people that I've met on this sort of sober adventure. But I think most people, and I think that's probably reflective of broader society, are still in the middle lane.
There's a discipline in there, right?
Mm.
you know, there is a discipline in there to be able to be right, okay, 28 days, right, 1 year, and now sitting here celebrating 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Because if you have that number of people around you, family, friends that are still boozing, but you're not, that's that. There's some fair amount of discipline. Do you think that comes through the football days? Do you think from being an athlete, a pro athlete? Do you think there's that's in there? Or do you think it was already in there, hence being able to become a pro athlete?
I think there's a bit of it in there. Yeah, I think there's, you know, I love to train still. I think there is that mentality of, well, I'll tell you what happened. I think what I realised, conventional wisdom had told me alcohol was great, it was fun, it was amazing. All my cultural clues and, you know, social clues said it's great. You know, parents, my idols, my heroes, they're all drinking. And then when I took a break, that's why I think I needed that 28 days.
Mm.
And I got to the end of that and I felt genuinely so much better. Slept like I hadn't slept, started to lose weight. I ended up losing 3 stone in weight. My resting heart rate went from 68 down to 42 where it is today.
So in what window of time is that?
That was very quickly. That was probably in about 90 odd days for me. It was a
90 days, 3 stone.
Massive shift in my physiology.
And heart rate, my health. Ability.
Just completely 68 down to 42 resting heart rate, which it basically is today. So the changes for me were dramatic as well in a short space of time.
And when Andy, so already before that, there's already the meditation.
Yeah.
There's all the, so that all the other practices are there.
Yeah.
But only just the removal of alcohol for the 90-day period, then you have 3 stone.
Traumatic,
and that heart rate variability.
Yeah, all the rest of the disciplines didn't really make much difference. And the reason they didn't
is because
I was so inconsistent with them all, because alcohol was undermining everything. I think this is my big point for so many people, that they're focusing really hard on all these other things, but those one or two drinks in the week undoes their nutrition, undoes their exercise, undoes their mental health. It's the thing. That's the root cause of everything for the middle lane that's been overlooked, like it was for me. And I think when I removed it and had all those incredible results and my business started to boom, I definitely was a better parent, definitely a better partner to my wife.
And became an author.
Yeah. Started doing all of these things. What that did for me, it made me realize that for me, conventional wisdom was wrong. What I was led to believe and what the masses seemed to believe clearly for me was wrong.
Mm.
And I think that really empowered me after that to think, right, just because lots of people believe something doesn't make it true. Everyone thought the world was flat at one point, didn't make it true. It's the same with alcohol right now. So I think that allowed me to sort of sidestep like what everyone was doing around me and think I'm going to go this alone. But hence why we started Bonnie No Beer. That was the origins of that, because there was no community. I had no one to lean on, which has now become Dry. So I have an app called Dry.
Yeah, that's D-R-Y-Y, right?
The extra Y, which I love.
What's so the extra Y?
It just
is it like
nice.
Dry Y?
It just looked nice.
Dry Y.
And there was two Ys.
It's almost like a Y be dry, yeah.
Yeah, there was two of us in it. So we had two big Ys. So
okay.
A bit of a, and it looked, Matt Pink, who designs it, he's in fashion and like, I'm terrible at this stuff. It just looked quite nice. But really built those communities. And I think that's what's made it easier for me to be surrounded by everyone that drinks, but really I've got this sort of community in my pocket. Or
still have your own council there, right?
Yeah, that all get it. That I can go in there and I can live it and breathe it and love it. And they're all cheering you on and I'm cheering them on and we're picking each other up when we're struggling. But then as soon as I step into the real world, I don't have to talk about it because people don't really get it. And I don't want to preach and I never preach. I just sort of show up and shine that message. And if people want to listen, they can. Mm. But that's why I think that alcohol-free communities, which has also been a beautiful thing. 10 years ago, there was none. Now there's this massive alcohol-free influencers, alcohol-free communities, books, you know, alcohol-free
fraternities. Dances, clubbing.
Love it. Yeah,
it's all available, right?
We've actually Dry has got Dry Fest. Dry Fest this year.
Is that the first one?
First ever Dry Fest is coming up this year.
I think it's unstoppable, this man. Okay, brilliant.
This is June. I think it's June 20th. It is going to be in Glastonbury. And actually, it was funny and this is Matt Pink's initiative, who does the boat parties. He's brilliant at all this stuff.
Yeah.
This is certainly not mine, but it's part of Dry Fest. The original weekend they booked it was the same weekend as Glastonbury. So they had to cancel that weekend, as you can imagine. But so first ever Dry Fest, Dry Festival. It's happening.
What are the dates?
I think it's the 20th of June, or close to that, if that's not Saturday.
In.
Come along to it. You'll love it. It'll be fun, wouldn't it?
What's the flavour? What have you got going on there?
Oh, it looks brilliant. Matt's done a great job of it as well.
Okay.
So it'll be all that sort of stuff. It's going to be dance, stages, the sort of traditional festival. And what we've done is made it over one day, because we were going to do it over 2 days. And then what we realized, we spoke to some really skillful people in the area, and they said most people camp a lot of the time at longer festivals because they've had a few drinks and they need to sort of collapse out of it. So we just said, let's just do it over a day. Let's just action pack it, which we're really excited about.
Yeah, man. I think, who did it? Medicine Festival. That's alcohol free.
Yeah.
You really feel it when you're there. Like the difference.
Yeah.
It's huge. Like the on an energy and energetic level, it's like something else. Community, that was again alcohol free. I was approached by someone that's putting a festival together, and it's, you know, we're putting together this wellness, well-being festival. And then when it came to kind of just the discussion around what that looks like and what the offering would be, then it got into the sponsors, and they're sponsored by because of booze, right? So much money in that world, right? And I was just like, I can't do it. How can I hold a well-being experience at a well-being festival if there's booze there? Because who's going to rock up, and what are the guarantees, and what I'm going to take them through an experience? What if they're drunk? What if they're hungover? What if they're, you know, so much involved with that. And to put it under a well-being and wellness experience of a festival and still have booze, it just doesn't marry up now.
Yeah.
You know, it does just start. There's no marriage there.
No, I mean, that in itself is just so refreshing, isn't it?
Because you can do it anywhere else. You know?
Yes, exactly. Every festival's got booze.
Yeah.
So what's the point in doing it if there's booze there? Because it's just like every other festival, just like it's a bit of an umbrella wellness thing. Do it properly.
Well, you're doing it properly in the sense that you're highlighting, well, this is what it's about. Yeah.
And I think for me, you know, it underpins well-being personally to take a break from alcohol. And again, I'm not anti-alcohol. I've never been, but I am pro-awareness. And, you know, in dry, we have mostly dry, which is those people that really live a mostly alcohol-free life, but might on occasion, for whatever reason, decide to have a drink. Not my story. That might be theirs. And also tactically dry. I'm seeing a lot of people do that as well, that take longer tactical breaks. Again, not my choice, but it's nice to broaden that, because I think I was quite, I would say militant, but I was like, what's the point in drinking? It makes no sense. And I think by broadening that brush a little bit, it's bringing more people into the space that's sober curious, that are interested, that might start tactically or mostly and end up, you know, on the fun side of the island permanently with myself once they've had that nice experience. So we've sort of broadened that brush slightly within dry, you know, which is lovely, because now we've got a really beautiful community in there.
Yeah. I think, you know, when people are on this journey, or if it's been, you know, say they're on, they want to do 90 days and they get to day 60 and they slip up. What's the advice?
Yeah, this is a really important topic, because I think so many people fall into that perfectionist mindset with anything. In the dieting world, it's called the what the hell effect. So a lady called Janet Povey noticed this, like people would do really well with their nutritional plan, get to about 21 days, slip up and go, what the hell? Diet's blown. I must just eat loads of shit. Yeah. And then they wake up 6 months later, you know, 8 stone heavier, and then start again. It's a little bit like that with alcohol. I think any behavioral change, we have this tendency to think if we're not perfect, we've failed. But actually, if you look at the science of behavioral change, James Prochaska created the stages of change model, which I love. And he was inspired because his dad was an alcoholic. And he was basically didn't trust the institution. So he wouldn't allow anyone to work for him. So James Prochaska was inspired to try and figure out how humans may change, create the stages of change model. Then put a lot of research behind it with smokers, with drinkers. And what he found was that for most people, it takes about 5 or 6 times around that loop of behavioral change before they make lasting behavioral change. So what does that tell us?
They make a new template to create the new behavior to the new consequence.
Exactly. Yeah. And what does that tell us? That actually slips, blips, whatever you want to call them, are baked into the change process. Therefore, it's most likely that most people at some point will slip. So if you frame that as an opportunity to learn, yes, it might hurt a little bit because you don't want to slip. But if you see it for what it is, where's the learning, then you bounce back stronger, you iterate, and then you crack it down the line. Whereas I think there's that cultural sort of mythology around a slip, snakes and ladders, you've failed, go back to zero, start again. Or even worse, if I slip, that means I've broken my momentum, therefore now I'm not going to be able to stop and I'm going to continue to drink. So for me, coaching, and maybe we can talk about that, coaching around that moment when it goes wrong is the most important moment, because what I noticed for years, having been involved in this, and we've coached literally hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions at this stage, really, through this process of changing their relationship with alcohol.
Firstly, brilliant. Well done.
Oh, which I'm genuinely so proud of. It's pretty cool. But the big thing that I noticed early on, I wouldn't talk about slip-ups. It was like Voldemort. If you've ever seen the Harry Potter shows, I was like, I'm just not going to mention slip-ups, because if I mention slip-ups...
That should not be named.
Yeah, that should not be named. I just won't go there, because if I mention slip-ups, am I giving people the license to sort of tactically slip up? And then obviously as I...
Oh, the permission to slip up, in other words. Yeah.
As I studied behavioral change, I started to realize actually that was the wrong approach entirely. The best way to approach it is to be really upfront and own it. The fact that actually most people will slip up, because that's part of the change process, and prepare for when you slip up in advance.
Yeah.
So the really skillful thing to do is not to sweep it under the carpet like I used to do, actually face up to it and go, right, if that happens, what are my options? Mm. What are my choices? And I think when you deal with it head on like that, when it happens, and it will do to a lot of people, rather than it being this shame moment when you're embarrassed.
Yeah.
And I would see people disappear. So they'd be in my programs or training with me and they'd go. And I knew what had happened.
And then you knew, yeah.
They'd had a slip up. They were embarrassed. They were ashamed. They didn't want to go back and see Andy. They didn't want to go back and be part of the group. They feel like they've let everyone down, beat themselves up, disappear. But then when we started to own the fact it might happen, these people would come back. Mm-hmm. And I'd see them the day after a slip up. They'd be in the group and say, do you know what?
Accountability.
Yeah, I tripped up. I've learned from it. I feel terrible. I didn't enjoy the night. It reminded me of all the reasons why I didn't want to drink in the first place. I'm going to keep going. And so many of those people now, again, are with me on this adventure for 8-9 years. So for me, if anyone faces that moment, it's prepare in advance. What are your options? So that when that moment comes, and it might do, you take the learning from it rather than being ashamed by it.
Mm. And yourself, have you been like in that 10 years? Have you been tempted in that 10 years? Did you have your slip ups in that 10 years? Have you been?
All of my slip ups were prior to that 10 years. Yeah. So I had that 2-year block of.
And really working through it.
Yeah, slipping, tripping, rubber arm twisted every time someone called me boring. And then, then I cracked it. And then I did a lot of the research. I went back and studied, I left school 16 to be a footballer. I went back to university twice to do a degree, master's degree in positive psychology and coaching psychology, NLP to figure out my own brain, really. And that was all part of that change process as well. There's a lot going on, and I started to figure out actually how our brains worked. And then that allowed me, I think, to crack, for me, the alcohol code. And I think from then on, really, I've just been trying to share that with as many people as possible.
Well, also the removing the alcohol created the space, the time, the energy to be able to study all that, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, that wouldn't be possible.
Think of what you've done in that time.
Yeah. It just wouldn't be possible. I mean, I remember actually talking about The Miracle Morning. I don't know if you've ever read that book, Hal Elrod.
No.
It's basically the most simple concept in the world. It's like, just get up earlier.
And you're part of the 5 a.m. crew.
Yeah, so it's a 5 a.m.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And that was a game changer for me, because that wouldn't be possible. So whilst I was still running my busy brokerage, so it's a full-on, city big job that, I'd get up at 5 o'clock every morning, which would give me till 7 o'clock in the end. That's 2 hours.
Yeah, like, I know it well. Yeah.
You change your life in 2 hours a day. I got fit in that day. I studied for my degrees, wrote a book, wrote another book, started the One In Obia movement, prepared for a TED talk. All of that lived in that 5 till 7 a.m. None of that exists had I been drinking. None of it. None of it exists. And that's the point I'm trying to make all the time. This is that point of where people are playing at. They think they're at 100%, but they're probably only at 60%. And that was me. I unleashed that extra 40%. And in that space was that time to go and do all these things that I'd always wanted to do. I wanted to be fit, wanted to be healthy, wanted to write, wanted to learn, wanted to study. And the beautiful thing about that is that opened up me to this world of entrepreneurship. And then eventually I escaped the golden handcuffs, which no one ever escapes in broking, because I owned a brokerage. So I own part of the brokerage whilst I'm in it. So no one ever leaves, because you can't take it with you. And I left. Again, I was probably the only person that's ever been alcohol-free in that industry, and one of the only ones that has ever really walked away from, which is a bit of a golden ticket, essentially, to do this entrepreneurial world, to follow my meaning and purpose, which has been the two greatest gifts, going alcohol-free and then stepping into this entrepreneurial world and escaping those golden handcuffs, has been the two greatest gifts of my life, I think, outside of my lovely family.
So going back, like way back to that brokerage days of making that decision, did you imagine where you'd be, like, as where you are now, How did you see yourself back then, thinking, where am I taking this? What's the why? How far can I go with this?
Yeah.
Are you way beyond where you'd imagine you'd be at that stage?
Oh, absolutely. When I first left, it was to follow the One You Know Beer adventure. So I didn't really know where that was going to go. And I actually didn't stay there very long. We sort of, again, for our own reasons, had a different philosophy around where it should all go. Mine was very much alcohol-free and this is the way to go. So I made another courageous decision to step down from One You Know Beer, even though I started that movement. I still own part of One You Know Beer, but I haven't been actively involved in it for about 4 or 5 years. But I think all of these decisions, I was only thinking about this on the way here, actually, all of the best decisions I've ever made in life have been the courageous ones.
Mm.
All the worst decisions in my life have been the ones that have been impacted by fear, or I haven't made a decision. Because to not make a decision is still to make a decision, right?
Yeah, it's the lean in for 15 or lean out.
Exactly. And you get stuck because you're making a decision all the time. So those courageous decisions to walk away from, which was a multi-million pound contract I had on the table to continue to run my brokerage, to effectively start with nothing, you know, just live off my savings and try and figure it out, which we did. Then COVID hit, which was wonderful. But it's been the best decision I've ever made. Now I own lots of different businesses. I do the thing that I love every day. We inspire more and more people. I'm involved in all these incredible different businesses, ideas, initiatives that we're creating, from documentaries to the Dry app and training our coaches. That's a huge part of what I actually do now. And I feel really empowered by that because now I'm in charge of my own destiny, doing what I love. I had the courage to step away from something that looked like I had my career all mapped out for me. Mm. And now I sort of own my time. I have total autonomy. I can work from anywhere in the world. I get to do lovely things like this instead of me trying to do this in a broom cupboard at work. That's how I used to do it before. I remember one time I did a podcast because no one could know that I was doing it, right? So I'm running the brokerage. I did this podcast in a broom cupboard in the office, and I can't think who it was with at the time, but one of the lads had then organized a drinks evening. So I'm doing the podcast thinking I'm just going to be able to open the door when I'm finished and just sneak out. And there's about 50 people have assembled outside the broom cupboard. So there I'm stuck in there going, I can't walk out the broom cupboard because it's just going to, so I just had to sit it out. I had to sit in the broom cupboard.
Brilliant.
Broom cupboard about an hour and a half and wait for everyone to eventually disappear and then sort of snuck out.
Love
so
that.
This is lovely. I can do this and tell the world about it. So
what a great share.
Yeah.
Andy in the broom cupboard.
Andy in the broom cupboard.
Yeah. Human potential. Human potential. That's what I feel, you know, for me, when the booze went out, you know, because to look at, I had all the kind of men's health mm. magazine kind of physique, worked on sleep, worked on nutrition, had all that bagged. And again, just the alcohol piece really, and copious amounts of cocaine that was it with that. Once that went, suddenly to become an endurance athlete for me, you know, made it possible. And then the human potential that perhaps we're not tapping into. Like you found 2 hours in the morning there, and through that 2 hours in the morning, books, study, you do masters.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, entrepreneur, several businesses, coaching business, all of that, that's in that window of time. That's 10 years, right?
Yeah.
Incredible.
I think that's what this is all about, isn't it? It is about human
untapped potential.
Yeah. That, you know, people are unaware of. That's the big thing that I'm trying to do. I think so many people right now are suffering. Again, in that middle lane, whether it be they're just not optimal in their relationships, their career, all those type of things. Maybe they're mentally not quite where they want to be. I think a lot of people lose ambition as well. I think it's a big thing that no one ever really talks about. I think alcohol actually takes away people's ambition. And I see that up close because I've seen my ambition come back in a big way to go and add value to the world. And so many of the people that I work with, I continually see that happen. They remove alcohol and suddenly that confidence comes back, that inner glow comes back, and it's like, right, these are the things that I want to do in this world. Mm. I think so many people, again, are sort of sitting below where they are optimally in terms of their drive, in terms of their ambition, and just don't know why. I think a lot of people might think it's middle age. I definitely thought that. I remember having a clear vision of, oh, this was when I was drinking. I know why I'm overweight.
Yeah, but that's, hold on, because that's like, you've been 39?
Yeah.
38, 39? Yeah.
So I remember then thinking, oh,
yeah,
this is middle age. You're meant to feel a bit shite.
And you're meant to wake rubbish. Up wrong side stiff in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here I am, you know, literally 10 years later, fitter, faster than in my 30s.
Yeah, man, vibrant.
I love it.
Yeah, powerful that. That's really powerful. also maybe them removing the language of what middle age is, because it, you know, why cap ourselves?
Oh.
You know, if I've hit middle age at 40, I'm only living till 80.
Yeah.
You know? Well, perhaps if you carry on with that same lifestyle, you know, but it's who knows where you can take it, you know? No, no guarantees, of course, but I think it's the quality of life in that space, right? If that is middle age and you're already halfway, what's the next half going to be like? Certainly sounds, if that's the last 10 years, it's going to be even more magical, right?
Yeah, I'm excited for it. And I always think about it, it's almost like that graph, isn't it? You probably see people about our age now, probably younger actually, in truth, 40, and it's that sort of slow decline, isn't it? You know, stop exercising as much, stressed out all the time, put on a bit of weight, and then, you know, body starts to disease a little bit, and then that decline into their 40s, 50s, lifestyle diseases start to pick up, not as mobile as they used to be, and then the last maybe 10, 20 years of their life are a fraction of where they'd like to be able to spend that in terms of their virality and zest and energy. And it's that sort of slow degrading, the medical care keeps you alive a bit longer, and then you sort of limp out of life.
Yeah.
Versus that, you know, I think it was Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, in life you get a choice whether you wear out or rust out. I choose to wear out. You know, and I want my
curve, out, rust out.
Yeah,
brilliant.
I want my curve to look like that sort of almost straight, like strong, powerful, like virulent, zestful, boom. Check out, you know, one of these days, strong. Like, what is that? And this is what I say to people, if I draw that in a graph, I'm like, what is that gap worth to you?
Yeah.
Think about what that gap is worth to you. Not just financially, what it's worth to you in terms of your life. It's huge. So everything you can do to bridge that gap, in my opinion, we should be doing. And for me, one of the biggest or the fastest ways to bridge that gap is remove alcohol.
Yeah. Did you ever have, like, I was just thinking about, you know, the super size me, you know, where the guy ends up smashing McDonald's, see what his stats are like. Did you have any vitals taken, like, back then, pre-sober, versus where you are now? Did you do any vitals? Did you have any heart check? Or?
Yeah. What's quite interesting, so I mentioned my dad had a treble bypass, so he had that, so it's about 12 years ago. So he had his treble bypass. I've got two brothers. So on the back of that, we said, right, we all better go and get checked out, you know, if it's a genetic thing or whatever's going on. So me and the two brothers, we all get checked out. Eldest brother, totally clean bill of health. Younger brother, clean bill of health. I'm the athlete in the family, like the professional footballer, living off those glory days at this stage, boozing heavy, doing everything you shouldn't be doing. But in my mind, I'm still an athlete. Do you know what I mean?
Still playing.
Yeah, still playing. I haven't been on the football pitch for like 15 years. And in my mind, I'm still fit and healthy. Clearly not. I did my tests. I've got early onset heart disease. So I walk into the cardiologist. So I'm mid sort of 30s then. And he's like, you're on the calcium scale, basically. So your arteries are furring up. Two brothers didn't have it. And funny enough, I remember walking there thinking, I walked past a doner kebab shop. This is how my mindset was at the time. Walked past doner kebab shop on my way to see him. And I thought, if I get a bad diagnosis here, this could be the last time I ever had a doner kebab. So I did one of those sort of cartoon like rewinds and went in and got myself a large doner.
On the way there?
Yeah, yeah. I thought, well, I've got to have one. Just in case.
Brilliant.
I get a dodgy diagnosis. And of course I did.
Yeah.
So he tells me I've got early onset heart disease. And I could see it in his eyes. He was like, well, your dad's got it. You've got it. It's genetic. Take some statins. And I came back a year later to see him. And I was so embarrassed. Nothing had changed. I hadn't done one thing. Literally nothing had changed in my lifestyle. I was doing everything I was still doing. Still eating doner kebabs, even though I told myself that was going to be the last one. And when I left, I was just toying with the idea of taking a break from alcohol. And I said, I'm going to stop drinking. And he looked at me with those eyes that said, no, you're not. I've seen, you know, thousands of people come through here. Humans don't make change. You know, I'm sure he's given everyone every diagnosis under the sun and consistently sees
Leopards
them come back.
Change their spots.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could see it and feel it in the energy from him that I won't change. Fast forward another year, I actually did stop drinking. So this is the start of my alcohol-free adventure. And I walked back into the room. This book is in Alan Desmond's. The story is in Alan Desmond's book, The 28-Day Plant-Based Revolution. Yeah. So I walk back in to see him again, and he just looks at me and says, literally scratches his head like this and goes, this is astounding. He said astounding about three times in the first 2 minutes. So I knew I was onto something. He went, you look. He couldn't get over how I looked, first and foremost, got on the scales. And he went, you know, I've lost 3 stone in weight. Your resting heart rate, this is just telling you,
he's got
6'8 down 42. And then he said, I'm just going to get the radiologist out.
Radiologist, yeah.
because he said, I've seen your, we've just done your stats again. He's literally scratching his head going, I don't quite understand. Like, so he calls him out and he says, it sort of looks as though you've paused this heart disease, but then it looks like you've reversed it. And he's like, we just almost like a scratching head moment of, we haven't really seen this before. So that for me, again, was this by the way, I had changed my nutrition at that stage to more of a plant-based diet as well. So I'd done everything that I thought I could do to be optimal, like literally everything. So I paused it and reversed it, which is pretty cool. So I've got to go back now. Now this is 10 years later. So I'm going to go back for my sort of 10-year checkup and I'll get some more stats. And
yeah, it'd be good to hear how that goes, man.
Yeah, let's hope that's on the right
check
side.
Check back in with that.
Yeah.
Well, you're looking great, man.
Yeah.
Shiny, vibrant. You know, that's where it's at, right? Who doesn't want to feel like that?
And yourself as well. This is the cool thing, isn't it?
Man, I mean, going back to templates, right? I'm 48 turning 49 this year. You're 49.
Yeah.
Right. This wasn't the template I had.
Yeah.
Like when I was young, of 49-year-old men, you know? First of all, just ground sitting for this length of time. It was very much like, ooh, back in the couch.
Yeah, yeah.
And, ooh, groaning to get up again, you know? So that, I think, also is just being a great example for others to observe.
Yeah.
You know?
We're changing the narrative, I think, of
that's
what
it.
It's all about. And enjoying it, like with a smile. That's the important bit for me, isn't it?
It has to be the joy, man. I was speaking to this earlier with someone. The joy piece, because a lot of the work, you know?
Yeah.
Doing the work.
Yeah.
It's so serious.
Yeah.
You know? And so it has to be light too, you know? We have to keep it joyful, right?
Yeah, and that's what you do brilliantly, and hopefully that's what I'm putting out to the world, and it inspires people. It's like, come on the journey with us. That's all we got to do.
Man, you are one big inspiration, so thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on the pod. How do we find you? How do people find you? How do they get involved? How can they be coached by you? How can they be coached by the coaches?
So andyramage.com
is
the main website. Big thing what I do now is train coaches as well, alcohol-free performance coaches, which I love.
Brilliant.
Instagram, Andy Ramage Official. Is the other place that I hang out. I'm pretty much live in there, or the Dry app as well. So you can download the Dry app. It's free to download, DRYY, wherever you get your apps from.
And get to the festival.
The Dry Fest is happening.
And look out for the documentary that's coming out. What was that? Yeah, it must
2025,
be
so probably January 2025 would be optimal.
They take their time, right?
Yeah, exactly. So keep
3-year windows on those
eyes
things,
and
right?
ears peeled for that. And if anyone's listening that is in the space and has got a great story to share, or you know they're an influence in the space, I'd love to hear from you.
Thanks, brother.
Yeah, you're a legend. Well done. Top work.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at The Natural Lifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love.